Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we meet the new UC Merced chancellor, and we hear from a family of mariachi singers. Plus, teenagers tell us how they're getting through the pandemic. But first, this week, the staff at Kaiser Fresno Medical Center said goodbye to Sandy Oldfield, a nurse at the hospital who died of COVID-19 after treating an infected patient. On Wednesday evening, hundreds gathered for a candlelight vigil to honor her memory. I spoke with one of the organizers of the observance, registered nurse Amy Arland, who works in the ICU. Thank you so much for talking with us today. To start out, I'd love for you to share a little bit about Sandy. What was she like and what kind of nurse was she?
Sandy was a telemetry nurse. She started off at Kaiser doing many different jobs at the time that I met her when I first moved to California. In the early 2000s, she was an LVN at that time, and that's kind of where I grew up, and she was an excellent mentor, very kind, compassionate person. I transferred to the ICU after a year on the telemetry floor, and I have not worked with Sandy much since then. My experience with Sandy over the last 2 months has been as an observant nurse watching the care being given to her in our intensive care unit by her coworkers.
And what was that experience like?
It is truly terrifying to face your own mortality because it's very much like Russian roulette. As a nurse, knowing that this pandemic was coming to our area, we kind of knew that some of us were going to get sick. It was just kind of who has to be the unlucky one. We had a total of 10 nurses that contracted the virus. Some of them did have to be hospitalized. Others still, after well over a month, are not well. Some of them have returned to work. And unfortunately, Sandy was the one who was hit with the worst case scenario of this virus, which we keep hearing hits only a small percentage of people. But to watch it be one of your own sisters, one of your longtime colleagues, to have to be on the receiving end of the care that we have to give to these people to try to keep them alive. And I think it is a testament to our excellent nursing care that as many other patients would have been expected to die from this very early on, as bad as it was, that we were able to give her every opportunity to survive this for over 2 months. So it has taken its toll on our entire hospital staff. Like I said, she was so lovable. You know, the janitors knew who she was. The care partners knew who she was. People in the clinics knew who she was. Everyone knew who Sandy Oldfield was. And her loss has just left a vacuum. And like I said, it's also very tough to have to face your own mortality in the way that every time we would have to enter that room to take care of her, we were putting ourselves at risk if we weren't careful, because we don't know enough about this disease to guarantee that we're not going to spread it to others or to bring it home to our families.
How has this experience changed your feelings or your concerns about your own personal safety and the safety of your family when you come home from work after a shift?
I think the hardest personal struggle I have had is being a nurse now for, gosh, my 20th anniversary will be next month. To be able to have to struggle internally with the thought of, is there a line that it's just too far to cross? At what point will I reach the decision where I'm going to have to say, no, I can't take care of this patient because you don't have the stuff that I need to be able to keep myself safe. So many nurses are very heroic by nature and altruistic and are willing to run into that room of a highly infectious patient to save their life if they are dying without even thinking about their own protection first. That's just who a lot of nurses are at heart. And I thought that's who I was. But it became a struggle for me when we found out that the maximum protection that we had agreed to use from the beginning, we had what we thought was the optimum protection, the right masks, goggles, gowns, gloves, foot covers, head covers. We were fully covered from head to toe just because you don't know what you don't know. And we did not know enough about this virus in mid-March to be able to say for sure how it was being transmitted and whether or not we were at risk of spreading it to our patients. So we were extremely cautious and used the highest standards that we had in our possession. And just within a matter of the first couple of weeks is when the relaxed CDC guidelines came out, and our employer immediately adopted them, which meant that the very high standard protections that we had agreed both with union representatives and management representatives was what we were going to provide our employees quickly was taken away from us because the CDC guidelines just were not even close to what we were using. So the nurses felt very stripped of protection, and that just increased the fear and the anxiety, the frustration of having to make these decisions every day, you know, whether or not the stuff that I'm being given to do my job, is it enough for me to keep going? We have had some nurses that have decided to quit during this and possibly even leave nursing altogether. We have had some nurses that are older nurses in their, you know, 60s that also have health problems and made the decision that they needed to retire earlier than they had planned.
Where are you at in your feelings about going to work every day? And what kind of protocol have you developed at home to keep your family safe?
Wow. I guess where I would describe myself is kind of at a crossroads. I haven't made a decision yet how much farther I'm willing to go when it comes to taking away the very protection that I need to make sure that my family stays safe. As far as isolation protocols, I received a phone call on March 8th. I remember the day, and it's probably, you know, like some of those very traumatic events that happen in people's lives. I don't think I'm ever going to forget that day, that I got a personal call from our chief nurse executive who knew I was very passionate about infectious disease protocols in our hospital and said, you know, we have our first patients coming in that could potentially be positive. Would you be willing, since you're on the task force, to set an example for all of the other nurses and volunteer to take care of this patient, which I more than gladly did. I had already been through all of the training. I felt very confident that I was going to be able to take excellent care of this patient and protect myself and my coworkers, and I had everything I needed. I was raring to go. I got sick on March 13th. The only way I can describe what I felt in that moment. Now, mind you, the patients that I was taking care of are what we call PUIs. That means they're under investigation. They're suspected of maybe having coronavirus, but it hasn't been proven yet. So we treat those patients as if they were positive for the virus until we have test results proving otherwise. So for the first 5 days, I was immersed in it. I was volunteering all over the hospital to take care of these patients wherever they cropped up because we really weren't sure where we were going to put them. They needed special isolation protocols, and that meant special rooms equipped with the right ventilation systems, and those rooms are spread out throughout the hospital. So we were still juggling with where to put them, so I kind of just went where the patients were. To be sick on the fifth day after my very first exposure made me full-on panic. I started tracing my steps back, thinking, where had I been? I had just been out of town for a union business trip. And I started to think about all of the people I had had direct contact with within that time frame. I hate to be crude, but it was almost like waiting on test results for an STD. I actually sat down. I had to make a list for myself of everyone that I could possibly think of that I had had any contact with in the previous 14 days to think that where did I pick it up from and did I take it to work with me and did I make my patients sick? I could have given it to anybody and I was afraid that I was the one spreading it. And then wondering if I would be in that 1% of people that got hit very hard with this virus and died. So my family and I gathered and we had a family meeting with my grown children who were staying here in the house with me at the time, my husband and my youngest, who is 9 years old. And then we have a friend that lives with us part-time. And we discussed it. And I let them know point blank, you know, here on out, mom's going to be taking care of these people directly, you know, the sickest of the sick. And there's a very good chance that I might get sick, but there's an even worse chance that I might bring it home by accident. So we need to talk about whether or not it's going to be feasible for me to stay at home and somehow keep a distance, or whether I was going to need to move out of the house for a while and maybe live in a hotel, or, you know, find a way to share an apartment with some other nurses, which is something I had heard people were considering. My family and I decided that because I do work so much and what little time I do get to be with my family is precious, that they wanted me at least to be in their presence. So we made a plan to divide up the house into my quote unquote quarantine zone and the house that the rest of the family would use. And then my grown children, their father also lives here in Fresno with us, close by. And so I had to discuss this also with my ex-husband and his family to decide if we were going to let our children go back and forth and visit anymore, and what that was going to look like if we actually were going to hardcore lock down 14 days of solid quarantine, which is what I was instructed to do. One of my children decided to stay here with me, and the other one decided to stay with their dad to kind of even it out. And so my oldest child, which was my daughter, who decided to leave with her father, her and I have not had physical contact or seen each other face to face since March 8th. We talk on FaceTime and on the phone, and we text a lot. She's considered an essential worker, so she continues to go to work because that's the only income she has, and it's not enough for her to live on her own yet. So she stays with her parents. And it was difficult for me to support her to continue to go out to work because I didn't feel like it was essential. I would have done anything to have been able to protect her and shelter her and keep her at home like I was doing with the other two kids, but she had to make that decision for herself.
Right. And what were your test results?
I ended up having to be tested twice because in the beginning, the test results were inconsistent and it took a very long time for us to get the test results back. So I was tested negative. The first time it took about 5 days, and the second time it took 8 days to get the results back. It was torture.
I could only imagine.
But to wait 8 days to find out if I had the plague. And that just meant that my quarantine was, you know, extended that much longer.
So I have to ask you, what are your thoughts about communities reopening?
I understand that people need to get back to normal. Like I said, it's been, what, 72, 73 days that I've been in self-isolation with no physical contact with my family, hardly at all. So imagine that I'm in the same house while school is going on downstairs and my 9-year-old needs help with homework, but I have to do it from 6 feet away. And my 24-year-old who is trying to do college online, you know, needs mom's computer for something, but you can't touch my COVID computer.
Right.
So yes, that was extremely hard. And so as far as reopening goes, I fully understand with my whole heart how people need a sense of normalcy. I need it for our own mental health. We know from all of the reports that are coming out that spousal abuse is on the rise and child abuse is on the rise, and people are trapped at home with no outlet for their emotions and feelings and fears that they're having to deal with right now. And a lot of people don't seek mental help because they simply can't afford it, or they don't have insurance that covers that. So for my own mental health, I would love for everything to be open. I need to go for a drive.
Right.
But as a nurse, what our community, I think, really needs to understand is the only way we can reopen in any incremental phases at all is if we have the hospital bed capacity to take care of the people who are going to get sick. It's not a matter of spread this around like peanut butter and some people are going to like it and some people aren't. Some people are going to be like my coworker, Sandy, who for some odd reason that we just still can't figure out, who is in the prime of their life, shouldn't die, but they do. And no matter what we throw at them, the hydroxychloroquine, the remdesivir, all of these, you know, miracle cures that we have heard about, we've tried them. And, you know, there's just no way to explain to anyone unless you actually come for a tour through an ICU what that looks like if you've never been inside of an intensive care unit, to have tubes coming out of every orifice to have a team of nurses and respiratory therapists and nurse assistants have to flip you over on your belly, how uncomfortable you're going to be because you can't breathe and a machine's trying to do it for you. So you're going to fight against that machine because that's just your instinct. It's way, you know, your body doesn't want those tubes. So then we have to put you to sleep, and it's a deep sleep for a long time. So your muscles begin to waste because you're not getting up and moving and exercising. And yet another team of healthcare workers have to come in now with physical therapists to exercise your arms and legs because you can't. This goes on for weeks. And then we have to start feeding you through a tube. And then to have no personal dignity at all, to be able to live like a human being, to have clothes on and be covered because you're burning up with a fever and we have to bathe you in ice every hour, to not be allowed to have your family and your friends be there to comfort you and assure you that you're going to be okay. Those patients die in isolation. So I understand people's need to get out and be around other human beings and get life back to normal because that's just what we need to exist and to be sane. But I don't have enough beds in my hospital for everyone. And that's the reality of it. None of our hospitals will have enough beds for everyone if they continue to open up without the proper protection in place, without making sure that we can massively test our population. Here in Fresno County, we've tested, 10%? I don't even think we've reached 10% yet of being able to test people. So that is a very small sample to even be able to gauge how many people are really sick in our communities. There could be people, entire families right now that actually are infected with coronavirus, but they're too afraid to go out. They have no health care insurance. They would not be able to afford a visit to the emergency room to even find out, not to mention they'd be terrified to know that they have it. Because who else have they been around? And they know how people are going to treat them because now they have this infectious disease. They're not going to be able to leave their home. They're going to be isolated and quarantined by the county, so they can't go to work. They can't earn a check. And that is terrifying for so many people that live here in Fresno. Sorry, it's a bit of a rant.
No, not at all.
What happens when a nurse gets no sleep?
No, this is such important and critical information. Thank you so much. On behalf of everybody who's listening, I want to say thank you. Thank you to you and to all of your colleagues for the work that you do every day to keep the community safe. I also want to say I am so sorry for your loss.
Thank you for affording me the time to share my story. I hope that there are people listening that take this seriously and know that your nurses love you all, and we want to keep you out of the hospital. We want you to stay safe and healthy, and please wear a mask when you're out and wash your hands. Those are the two most important things. I don't want to see a second wave. The first one was hard enough on us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Teenagers are grappling with a lot these days, from new caretaking roles to boredom. FM89's news director Alice Daniel spoke with Deshae Lee and Faith Vega. Both are high school seniors in Fresno and interns at a youth organization called Californians for Justice. Deshae starts by describing what it's like to be at home all day with younger siblings.
For starters, it's like been loud because me and my mom, we get on like calls so they can like hear the background, and so it's like really loud, and they don't really get along as much, so it's like even louder when they start arguing. Me and my sisters, we've been like trying to like take turns watching my brother. He's one.
And so it becomes challenging when you're trying to do Zoom calls or do schoolwork. You get a lot of background noise. And I know both of you have parents who do essential work. I know, Deshae, you said your mom does work from home. Faith, you've had some concerns about your parents' safety. Tell us what they do and why you're worried.
Well, my parents are essential workers. My dad works at Amazon and my mom works at Save Mart. And it's definitely concerning because they're surrounded by a lot of people. It's kind of scary because they only my dad only wears a face mask. And yeah, they're supposed to be social distancing, but I guess it's like really hard for them to do that and do their job adequately and correctly. yeah, I think it's pretty scary.
So that probably causes a lot of anxiety for you. I'm wondering, what do you think has been the most challenging thing about this pandemic for teenagers? Do you worry about your own mental health or that of your friends?
I definitely worry about my friends' mental health. I think that my mental health, I've kind of have it in check, and I do stuff to take care of myself, but it's definitely concerned me about my friends because I know they're always anxious and they always worry about what's going to happen next and stuff like that. So it's definitely concerning for me as a friend.
And do you think it's the uncertainty and sort of being cramped in an apartment or a house? What do you think is causing the anxiety?
I think it's definitely the uncertainty and also the fact that we've never experienced something like this. So it's hard for them to know how to feel and know how to deal with it. So I think that's also the reason.
Deshae, what about you? Are you hearing similar comments from your friends?
Yeah, I'm in contact with some of my friends, but most of them, I'm not sure what they're experiencing. Like, I'm not sure if they're going through something that's like depression or anything. But yeah, I feel like us being like cramped in like a house or an apartment is like giving them like feelings like, what do I do? Like, you know, I don't know.
So tell me, you're both part of a statewide youth organization called Californians for Justice, which fights for racial justice in education and communities. Let's start with you, Faith. What has the pandemic taught you or maybe highlighted for you in terms of injustice?
Well, the pandemic has definitely opened my eyes to seeing that we actually need organized. Well, I knew that we always needed organization, but it just showed me the importance of it and how we need to fight for what we deserve and what we need in a community. So I think that really, the pandemic has really shown me that.
And Deshae, what has this whole pandemic highlighted for you in terms of injustice?
Just being in like the Californians for Justice, it shows like that they give us like a lot of support with like school and like they're always there for us, like they give us the opportunity to like release whatever needs to be released and like the stress of like watching my siblings and stuff and like being at home 24/7, and it's like it gives us someone to talk to, you know, and like have a bond with. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, no, I mean, it's interesting because do you feel like more teenagers would benefit from having someone to talk to right now?
Yeah, because like not all of their friends like know how to like talk to them, because I know I don't know how to talk to people like if they're feeling like some type of way, like sad or something, like because that's just not like something I can like deal with.
So yeah, so having more professional advice sometimes could be beneficial.
Yeah.
And both of you have plans to go to college next year. Deshae, you're going to Fresno City College, which was your plan all along.
Yeah.
Faith, you were going to CSU Long Beach?
Yeah, I was. I wanted to attend there, but the pandemic, it made it hard. And I didn't want to pay like $6,000 for online education, where I could go to Fresno City for 2 years for free and get the same quality of education there.
So the pandemic and having the courses online made you realize that it really wasn't worth spending the money because you weren't getting the actual college experience?
Yeah.
And you both go to Fresno Unified Schools. Deshae, you go to McLean, and Faith, you go to Edison. And the district chose to give you your third quarter grades for the fourth quarter with the option of doing extra credit work if you wanted to raise those grades. Was that a good solution for you?
For me, my grades were already pretty good, so I didn't really have to do a lot of extra credit work. But I feel like it would be hard for people who in the beginning didn't have access to internet or computers. I feel like it would definitely be a struggle for them. So I don't know if it was a good solution for everybody at the beginning, but now that the district is offering hotspots and computers, I think it ended up helping a lot more people than it did at the beginning.
And so, what about you, Deshae?
Yeah, my grades were also good, like from third quarter.
So what would you say has been the most challenging thing for you during this pandemic?
I would say finding something to do, like since I'm not at school. I started working on my paintings more because in school I was in art and we did a lot of painting and stuff. So that's what I've been working on for the most part, and, you know, watching TV. Yeah, just trying to find new hobbies and things to do with myself.
And watching out for your siblings at the same time.
Yeah. Yes, that too.
And what about you, Faith?
I think the hardest part for me during the pandemic is trying to make sure my days aren't all the same. I read a lot, so I'll read books, or I'll draw, or I'll crochet. I like to do that a lot. Or I'll watch TV with my siblings.
So is that advice you would give to other teenagers right now?
Yeah, I think that you should definitely try different things and try different routines.
And you both said that you have worried about your grandparents. Can you talk a little bit about that, Deshae?
With my grandma, in the beginning, like when quarantine first started, my grandma, she had got a chemical in her eye to where she had to go, or like her eyes started swelling up. So she had to go to the hospital, and it was like, she didn't tell, well, she told my aunt because my aunt drove her to the hospital, but she didn't tell my mom, and my mom's like really the one that was like really panicking, you know, because she, like being at the hospital right now is a high chance that she could get COVID-19 because, you know, most of the sick people are going to the hospital to get help. And also my grandma, she was originally the caretaker of my little brother. He's one, or both my brothers, the 10-year-old and the 1-year-old. And we decided to like stop that for a while because just in case my brother, he was sick at some point, and we didn't want him to be around my grandma so she doesn't catch it, because they say older people are more, they have more of a chance to catching the virus. So we decided to like hold back on going to my grandma's house and like staying away, you know?
So that's nerve-wracking for everyone in the family. And what about you, Faith? How has your relationship been with your grandparents?
Well, my house is right next door to my grandparents' house, so I definitely have to take care of them more often now that the pandemic is in full force in here. I make sure they've eaten, all their clothes are washed, and I clean their house. I try to keep my distance, kind of, but it's definitely been a challenge not to show my grandparents affection and give them hugs and stuff like that.
Well, let me just ask you one more question. You're both graduating from high school this year. Do you feel like you're missing out without having a traditional graduation?
Yes, I do, but I understand why we can't have a graduation like that. And I think that, and like, it sucks, but I understand why. And President Unified said that eventually down the road that we'll be able to have that. So I guess we just have to be patient.
Right. Well, let's cross our fingers that that someday is soon. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for talking to me, Deshae and Faith. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. While UC Merced continues to deal with the pandemic, it's also ramping up to ultimately double in size after the completion of Merced 2020, a public-private partnership that will enable the university to educate an additional 10,000 students. And it's about to get a new leader. The UC Board of Regents announced last week that Juan Sanchez Munoz will become the university's fourth chancellor. As a UC alum and first-generation student, he has a lot in common with UC Merced's student body. He currently serves as president of University of Houston Downtown and was still in Texas when I spoke with him just days after the announcement.
UC Merced is a really unique university in its location, in its age, in the population of students that it serves. And as I was looking at your academic background and your research background, you know, it came to me that, or I have to assume rather, that some of the things that set UC Merced apart are the exact things that probably drew you to the institution. Can you just talk a little bit about your background?
My research, I've been a long time interested in the principle of equitable access to high impact, high rigor opportunities to learn. And so one of the aspects of the university in terms of its percentage of first generation students, which is disproportionately high for a research institution, the percentage of diverse students, both in terms of Latinos, Asian, African Americans, and students from other countries is significant. And the economic diversity of its students is an important factor. And many of the students also come from that general region, which is to say that they come from a family that is familiar with the agricultural industries. And so it creates a very dynamic milieu for learning to take place there. And one of the things that I think is no secret about the University of California system writ large is its expectations of rigor and excellence. And so when you combine access to high impact content and faculty with an environment that demands, expects excellence and high achievement, that bodes very well for people that come from modest backgrounds.
So what are your priorities for the university?
Well, I would say, again, not having not arrived on the campus and visited with the leadership who also have priorities, as well as the deliberations that have taken place, I want to just preface my comments by saying that these are just some initial sort of thoughts. I think, obviously, we need to continue to prosecute the high research expectations of the university. The students want to attend the University of California Merced because of its reputation, its gravitas, its faculty, its research. And so we need to always be mindful of enhancing that aspect of the university. We need to think very carefully about how we support the faculty, how we support the staff that work there, how we support the students that have an interest in attending the institution. So those are sort of the basic blocking and tackling of I think successful higher education. We want to look at what sort of investments we're going to make in enhancing the physical capacity of the institution. We want to look at how we're interacting with K-12, obviously, how we're interacting with our community college partners. What kind of partnerships are we involved in with other UC campuses across the system, other institutions across the state and the country, and then make the appropriate investments of time, talent, or treasure.
One thing that COVID-19 has exposed is the educational inequities in our systems, particularly around access to technology, support, and other resources. So how do you plan to go about addressing those inequities in an online environment?
Right. Well, there's no doubt that the delivery of content virtually presents certain challenges. The families that, for as you've indicated or at least implied, may not have access to the internet, may not have bandwidth at their home, may be sharing bandwidth, may not have the technology to access the internet, may not have the technology of sufficient sophistication to access and download all of the content needed for learning. I think that this is playing out both in K-12 education as well as higher education to some extent. And so we need to be mindful of these inequities. We need to create strong social student support services that very quickly identify those students. Not all students are going to have inadequate or inequitable access to technology, but some will. And so what we want to do is find out who those students that suffer that inequity are, how we can support them, how we can maybe provide some financial assistance for some technology. I will tell you, for example, my current institution, one of the things that we did was we were going through a natural process of what's called refurbishing or replacement. And that is looking at your computer labs after 3 to 5 years and just updating them with newer technology. We refurbished, we wiped all of those desktops, and we made hundreds available to our students at very, very, very low cost. And hundreds of students took advantage of that program because they simply did not have the technology at home to access their coursework. So that is an example of a university saying, what can we do within our existing resources to help hundreds of students who may not have the technology? Well, we're going through this natural cycle. We had already budgeted the replacement of all these units. Can we make them available to some students for their use and that they would permanently keep? So there are things that institutions can do. And then obviously there are some inequities that a university, a college, even a system have limits to address.
So running a university is really like running a city. I mean, you're dealing with competing interests, finite resources. It's a challenging job under any circumstances, and you're starting it in the middle of a pandemic. I appreciate the fact that you have just been announced as the chancellor delegate, and the transition is going to be ongoing. But what can you say about how it's going so far and what you think the transition is going to look like?
Right. Well, again, I'm about 48 hours into it, so I would characterize it that it seems to be going as well as possible. mostly I'm introducing myself to people like yourself and those other, and other stakeholders in the community. And so I will say that I am hopeful that I will be able to very quickly assimilate much of the information needed to help make some informed contributions to the leadership. I will make the point, Kathleen, that while I understand and respect the position of a president or a chancellor, universities are led by an aggregation of leaders that are equally invested in its well-being and in its future. So my position is that I, with the provost and the deans and department chairs, will make the decisions that we think are in the best interest of the university. There are the decisions that we make for the summer, in my case, likely my contributions will have more of an impact for the fall. And then what we do beyond that, here's a little bit of a difference, Kathleen, and I've spoken to any number of colleagues and counterparts across the country. Unlike traditional higher education planning, where you think, here's what we're going to do for the academic year. I think COVID-19 has caused us to stop and say, okay, what are we going to do this summer? For example, most schools transitioned, continued the online delivery through the spring and into the summer. Many schools decided we would teach entirely online this summer. Well, in the fall, people are planning for different scenarios, face-to-face, face-to-face hybrid, online, a disruptible fall. And so what's a little different is the truncatedness of our planning. Instead of saying for the whole year, now we're looking at summer in a very sort of truncated, specific way, the fall, the same, and then the spring, because things hopefully could be very, very much improved by the late fall, early spring, and then that would then be a catalyst for different kind of planning.
Well, Dr. Munoz, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and look forward to when you are on campus.
Well, I appreciate that. And again, I thank you for your interest in the university. I think UC Merced is going to be fine. And I think we're going to work together through all of the challenges that this pandemic presents this summer and into the spring, into the fall, and hopefully, a much more optimistic spring. But your support and interest in the campus is very much appreciated and necessary. I look forward to meeting you when I finally arrive in the city.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Nakiko Masumoto and Bryn Saito founded the Yonsei Memory Project to honor the stories of Japanese Americans. And when the pandemic hit, they created a new program to give voice to Valley writers. It's called Valley Writers Respond. With funding from the California Wellness Foundation, they asked three writers to share their wisdom about the times we're living in, and they gave each writer a prompt. Here are excerpts from their essays.
Hi, this is Will Freeney, and this is my selection on the word breathing. The Davis Sutter Hospital ER on a Sunday morning resembled a ghost town. It was just me and my ride there, plus one doctor and one nurse. For a week, I had been unable to breathe without coughing, unable to cough without doing so convulsively, to the point of dry heaves. Without a fever or any digestive symptoms, I was still the sickest I had ever been in my life. After having a few x-rays taken, the doctor and nurse came out to visit me in the waiting room. With wide, sincere eyes, they looked at me in tandem. "We have bad news and worse news," the doctor said without a grin. "You have pneumonia," the nurse informed me, deadpan. "And emphysema," the doctor continued. "It shows up in the x-ray, but it's not bad yet. If you quit smoking now, you could live many more years of enjoyable life. If you don't, it's going to be short and unpleasant, a steep downhill ride." He turned to a nearby table, plopped down a blank pad of scripts, and wrote, scrawled really, "Never smoke again." That was in 2009. With a few one-off exceptions, I have followed that prescription, and I have hiked in the Sierras, ridden my bike everywhere I went, run a handful of 5Ks, swum more than ever, life has been good, and its quality has been retroactively contingent on that dynamic duo in the Davis ED. I owe them more than my insurance could ever pay. I owe them more than the Medicare that I have lived long enough to be eligible for could ever pay. I owe them my ability to breathe. I am indebted to their timely diagnosis and to the strict compassion of their prescriptive prognosis. And that is why I have no problem with wearing a mask and gloves and standing 6 feet away from any and all people in my environment and limiting that environment as much as possible to my own solo habitat. All I have to do is breathe and chill.
Hi, I'm Samina Najmi. I teach at Fresno State in the English department, and the guide word given to me was distance. So this is an excerpt from an essay titled Distance Learning. Grading in May is always frenzied and exhausting. This year, with teaching as we knew it cut off in mid-March by the threat of COVID-19, the depletion, I feel, seems self-indulgent. My students have lost livelihoods. One lost his father. Some have no choice but to brave the danger and pick up hours as essential workers. Many students, some of whom are also parents, find themselves displaced and depressed in living situations that inhibit their ability to learn. With their hardships in mind, I opted to teach asynchronous classes without Zoom meetings so they could participate in online discussions in their own time. It meant an exponential increase in class time for me. But 2 weeks into this online transition, a misnomer because there could be no transit time, only an abrupt launch into another dimension, my students expressed an overwhelming appreciation of our format as the least stressful in their new lives. And so I stayed the course. As a friend with greater experience of remote instruction puts it, there's so much wandering and herding in online teaching. The metaphor lingers, though it obliterates the individuality and mindfulness of my students. I did indeed expend a lot of energy taking count. Who appeared, who disappeared on the Canvas discussion board? How often and for how long? If they had wandered, from what? Towards what? Or does the verb by definition imply a lack of purpose in either direction? And what then is the role, the point even, of the shepherd? There were 6 students I couldn't get back after we moved online, though I tried and they tried. The shepherd's vigilance proved futile. The proddings failed. The morning I submitted course grades for the semester, my son walked in on my grief for the distances I couldn't bridge. When I told him, through sobs, that I had lost 6 students, he thought I had lost them to COVID-19. And in a way, I had. Emergency remote instruction, we called it. Distance learning, we say. It's a hard thing to recognize, let alone accept, when remoteness becomes a receding, a wandering into meadows beyond the sight and call and reach of love.
Hi, my name is Stephen Church, and I'm going to be reading the end of my essay, Understanding the Fox. And my key word was wonder. I didn't appreciate the CGI fox in the film Wild, but I understood it, because if you can't capture serendipity, you have to manufacture it. But part of me just wanted to hear Cheryl Strayed's voice, her words at least, telling me about the fox, the blessing, the omen, just enough for me to imagine it and nothing more. I wanted to see it with my mind's eye and let it exist in that realm of mystery where it seems foxes always exist, at the edges of your peripheral vision, in the penumbral regions of experience. Andrea says that foxes are magical, but of course they're not. They're perfectly natural, highly adaptable creatures who thrive in urban environments, often in the shadows. It's true, though, that to see one always feels as if you've been visited by a ghost or some ambassador from the other side. It always feels magical, like the fox has been watching you all along, waiting to reveal itself, as if it has chosen you at this particular moment to receive its blessing. And I'll tell you, dear listener, I did feel blessed by this long-bodied fox with his pointy nose, short ears, and that wild reddish-brown blast of a tail. Its coloring wasn't CGI red, but grayer or mottled like a tree trunk, perfectly suited to its urban environment. And I felt suddenly and seriously lucky. Foxes are solitary and fiercely territorial. So in a city, their home range may be quite small. And chances are that if you see a fox in your neighborhood, it is a resident fox who lives nearby, probably in a hidden backyard burrow. It is your wild neighbor. Friends and family have also reported fox sightings in Fresno, and they're not talking about the soccer team. They seem to be everywhere. The experts say that they aren't necessarily more animals roaming free now in the age of pandemic. They haven't suddenly decided to emerge from the shadows because they think we're not looking. They haven't actually chosen us. It's just that we're paying more attention. We're finally looking. We're taking the time to stop and stare out the window, or to look up at the sky. We're choosing to allow space for wonder in our lives. We're allowing space for the fox. And this may be the most important survival skill we can cultivate. Now I'm going to end, if I can, with a little writing or thinking activity. Wonder as a word is really quite wonderful. It is a verb, it's a state of mind, it's a thing in our collective consciousness. Ask yourself what it is like to feel wonder, and when was the last time you felt it? Think, if you will, of the 7 wonders of the world. List as many as you can come up with off the top of your head. What do they have in common? How are they different? Are there only 7? What makes something a wonder of the world? What makes something a wonder of your world? What would be your list of the 7 wonders of the coronavirus pandemic? And how would that list be different if there wasn't the pandemic?
To read the entire essays, go to yonsei-memory-project.com. The project and all of its writers are donating funds to help other artists through the Fresno Art Council's Safety Net Fund. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last August, we introduced you to a Delano teen who had just released her own mariachi album and was preparing to attend Harvard University with her older sister. In mid-March, sisters Anai and Xochitl Morales returned home to Delano to finish the school year online due to COVID-19. FM89's Laura Satsui checked in with the pair and their father, Juan Morales, who teaches music at the Mariachi Studio. The family just released a series of songs on YouTube called Working from Home and spoke about their lives during the pandemic, from teaching music online to playing together again.
My name is Juan Morales, and I am in our home in Delano, California. I play the mariachi guitars and the harp and the violin and the trumpet.
My name is Anai, and I mainly play the violin and I sing also. When we were brainstorming songs to play, well, they were the songs that we would play or sing like with our family. We would have big family gatherings with all of our tías and our tíos. So like one of the songs that we did, Puerto de Ilusión, was like my grandparents' favorite song. And so that's sort of a staple whenever we do play together.
My name is Xochitl, and I play the mariachi guitars, the guitarron guitar, vihuela, and the violin and the trumpet. And I also think no one really expected it to be going on this long. I think I just expected to be home for an extended spring break. And then by the time we got home, it was just kind of like, oh yeah, this is going to be much longer. A couple weeks ago, I went back to Boston and moved all my things, and now I'm back in California quarantining again before I go back home.
We normally don't teach lessons when we're on campus over there, but since being home, we've had a lot more extra time to devote to teaching and helping out our parents with the studio.
The lessons have continued online. We had the last recital here at the house, and we announced that the lessons might be suspended or moved to the online platform until the district said it was safe to come back, and of course that never happened. Yeah, it's nice to have the extra free time. I used to drive an hour and a half every day to and from work. So just having that extra couple of hours a week, you know, gives you the freedom. I've taken 3 classes since we stopped going to work in person. But it is definitely hard on musicians. For us, for example, we had the mariachi and we had performances almost every weekend. And that was a source of income for us. And also I was laid off from work. I am a music teacher. And when things get rough, you know, the first thing the schools let go are the arts, the music programs.
Corrido de las Heladas, which is about the time it snowed in Central Valley in the 90s. That one especially is special to us because our dad wrote it.
I think the last time we played together was at Anaí's participation at Los Lobos concert in Bakersfield. Was that in
January?
Yeah. In January. That was really nice. Before that, I think it was at Sochi's at the Get Lit event, right, Sochi? And we did the protest song.
Yep.
Sochi, do you miss playing?
I do miss performing, but I feel like I'm not as much a performer as the rest of my family. I don't know. I feel like I'm much more behind the scenes person. So it's been like a nice time to just kind of focus on individual projects and like make things without the pressure of having to perform.
And so it definitely feels weird to not have an audience anymore, but also not to be able to play with like all of our friends and with other family members, just because we have to stay at home. It's a different vibe, but I feel like it's still a special experience because, well, yeah, it's special in that sense that we get to share the experience as a family.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.